Hope you're having a great day. Our last show in March. Can't believe that. Already turning the calendar soon to April. Looking forward to that. And looking forward to your calls and questions. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. We just had someone call in about a question for Patrick Dolan, but they hung up. I guess we didn't get to him soon enough. Or if we dropped the line, please call on back caller. I'll introduce Patrick Dolan right now. Hey, Patrick, how are you?
I'm good. Sorry, John. That was one of my kids, probably.
Oh, yeah. And you just told him, never mind, don't ask that question.
Right. Right. I have no idea what the answer is, so don't ask that question on the air.
No. Let's get it out there if we need to. We can do.
Good to be with you, John.
Patrick, it's good to chat with you. How's everything?
Everything is great. Super busy.
Yeah.
Really enjoying the warm, windy weather. It's great for a couple days.
Are you busy in a good way, or are you busy in the way that I talked about in the tease of, are people calling you because they're starting to get laid off?
Probably more the latter. Yeah, we're doing a lot of separation agreement negotiations. So, and not as many, unfortunately, employment contract negotiations. So I think, you know, a lot of folks are losing their jobs right now, unfortunately.
Are you getting calls from federal workers still? I know we talked about that during that period where there was the buyout or something that they kind of had, and it went through the court system. Or are you getting more from the private sector?
Yeah, more from the private. Less federal employees calling us now. It was absolutely a lot of folks for a while there, but less so now. But, you know, that's still an unanswered issue, John, as you know. I mean, a lot of that is just hung up in the courts as to what agency is going to be required to bring some folks back, and are there going to be more layoffs? So, you know, we just don't know answers as to what those numbers are going to look like.
113 on WGN. I suppose we should set this up a little better. Patrick Dolan's an employment lawyer, if you didn't hear me mention. He's with Conte and Dolan of Karen Conte fame. And Patrick, why don't you remind everyone kind of what you do, broadly speaking?
So I am an employment lawyer. Any workplace issues I help folks out with. Could be separation agreements, contracts, if you're having issues with regard to discrimination or harassment or retaliation in the workplace. Or if you just have questions about how to handle a situation with a colleague or a boss, I get a lot of those sorts of questions, too. Like, how do I deal with, you know, being harassed in the workplace? What do I do about that? And so I help folks with those things as well.
I know a lot of people worried about certain classes being less protected than they were in the past due to new administration. I know a lot of that's dictated by state law primarily, right, Patrick? Like, you're not seeing any major changes on the horizon for people in terms of which discrimination cases they can or cannot bring up.
No, you know, it's state and federal, John, as you know. But in Illinois, most of the protected categories are in state law. And as we've seen recently under Title VII, which is the federal law that protects employees, there's some rollback in terms of the protected categories, for example, in terms of gender identity, in transgender issues, stuff like that. So we're seeing some rollback, but a lot of that is still protected in many states, including Illinois.
708 texted on in. I used to get a ton of hours for my job in the city when they passed the new PTO law that mandated folks, even hourly employees, get PTO. I noticed the management team giving me less hours, spreading the wealth around people that are less qualified than me so that none of us met the threshold. Is that legal? That's an interesting question for the 708.
It's a really interesting question, and I would say, generally speaking, it is. If an employer is reducing hours across the board in a way that's equitable, in other words, it doesn't discriminate against anybody on the basis of, say, age or gender or race or something like that, and those hours are being reduced to the point where you're not meeting PTO, triggering PTO obligations on the part of the employer, it's actually fine. I don't see anything illegal about that.
Although that doesn't seem right and fair.
Yeah, I mean, that's a different question, John.
Yeah.
You know, right and fair is often a different question. And frankly, you know, folks ask me about right and fair a lot. And I have to say, maybe it's not, but it's not illegal. And so there's only so much maybe you can do about that.
So in a phone call, you give them the moral victory, but you don't give them the legal ramifications that they were hoping for.
Yeah, and I actually just try to provide them with information that, you know, hopefully makes sense to them so they can understand where that line is and feel at least informed about, you know, what's legal and what's not, and then they can take whatever steps they want to.
Yeah, it's interesting, that PTO rule. For those that don't remember, this was about a year ago it went into effect. And I think, I'm just talking off the top of my head, Patrick, I think you get an hour of sick and regular PTO time for every 35 hours worked, as long as those 35 hours come within a single month. So if employers don't want to give you PTO and they have multiple employees, they can kind of spread that out. So maybe they don't completely eliminate giving you PTO hours, but they give you less PTO hours because they kind of spread it out so that no one's getting the bulk of the hours. You're saying that may not seem super nice or great, but it doesn't seem to cross over a line into illegality.
Yeah, I think that's right. And also on, you know, that's the city of Chicago level, John. So state of Illinois, outside the city here, it's 40 hours. So for every 40 hours you work versus 35 in the city, you are you get 1 hour of PTO and paid sick leave up to 40 or 35, depending on where you are.
Right, but the city went up a little bit more than that in terms of not only the hours, but they give you sick and a PTO.
That's right. It's both. But it's right. Those are separate banks, separate categories. You get
and it matters
one
where
one
the work
each.
Is done, correct?
It does. That's exactly right, as to what law protects you.
Oh, man, that's a bummer. Yeah, they followed up and they're saying, man, I kind of wish the PTO law hadn't passed. I got a lot more hours and a lot more pay. PTO seems like a good thing, but that might have been an unintended consequence of the law.
Maybe, but you know what? Most employers obviously have PTO policies that are triggered based on hours worked, so I'm not sure it's different. I think the law provides a floor, right?
Right.
Like for companies that don't have a PTO policy, at least now these employees get PTO and get paid sick leave that they can use. So
yeah. I just saying, Patrick, but at these hourly employees, and I talk to a lot of them at different places, I often ask, have you gotten less hours? And a lot of them say yes.
Yeah, I think yes, in my experience as well.
It's Let's Get Legal. We're powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. We got our full show today. Feels good to be back. Hey, Patrick Dolan, I got a question for you.
Sure, go ahead.
When can I start paying my son for work rendered for my business and put it into a Roth 401k? Maybe that's a financial question, not a Patrick Dolan question.
So, wait, you're asking how much does a person need to work before they can deposit money?
Well, I know a lot of people like to say they can pay their kids as part of their business. You know, I have a side business.
Sure.
And as long as it's like legit work done, and then I can set him up with a Roth 401k so he can save for his own future. I was mainly making a joke, Patrick, because he's 3 weeks old. So.
Oh, your son. Sorry, I thought it was a caller. You know what? Here's my suggestion, John. Start the 529 now. Just start that college savings plan now. Have you done that yet?
He doesn't have a social security number yet, so I can't.
Well,
but.
Just in a savings account. You know, Mike just told
just
me to tell you
just give it a couple
that.
Weeks. It'll
no, you got to start it now, my friend. Start it now.
I can't. He doesn't have a social security number. By the way.
It's too late. It's too late already. Forget it.
The whole process for all of this is just a quick aside. I went to the social security office yesterday. Turns out I wasted a trip because the hospital handles all this, which I'm sure someone told me at some point is exactly how it's done, that vital records gets the record of the birth. We have the birth certificate, and then they send it all to Social Security. But I gotta say, I was expecting it to be a real mess at the Social Security office, but I was able to make an appointment. I went and it was crowded, but I was called right at my time. The lady was super helpful, explained the whole situation, knew exactly what I was going through, because, you know, our situation's a little bit different with surrogacy and all that sort of stuff. And she's like, don't worry, they're going to contact you in a couple weeks. And if you don't, you just come back right here and we'll take care of you.
I think
how about that?
John, that's fantastic. But 18 years goes quick. So the 529 started today. Please.
I know, Patrick. I host a financial show. You don't think I'm going to start a 529
never,
the moment I can?
I've never listened to that before. I didn't know that.
Ray Kaplan has beaten it over my head for 3 years that I start the 529 as soon as I can. Because you know why? Compounding interest makes that key. All right, let's focus on that on Monday on the financial show. Back to employment law.
Got
questions,
it.
Patrick. What else are you noticing, hearing out there in the workplace?
Well, let's just address a few separation agreement threshold questions right now.
What does that
so,
mean?
Well, you know, I get a lot of questions of like, well, isn't severance? Don't folks have a right to severance in Illinois? The answer is no, right? Unless
no law saying
there's
you have
no
to get severance.
Law that requires employers to pay anyone severance under any circumstances, unless. It, you know, it exists in a contract. That right to severance is in a contract. And people are like, well, I don't have a contract. I have an offer letter. Well, an offer letter is almost always an enforceable agreement.
Oh, it is?
It is, absolutely. There'll be terms in there that will support an enforceable contract practically every single time. So if you have a severance note in an offer letter, it doesn't even have to be, you know, official letter. It could be in an email communication about the terms of your job, just something that outlines the terms that could support your right to separation pay and
so
benefits,
if you had gone back and forth with HR during the hiring, the onboarding process, and they mentioned, and yeah, we have a severance package as well, here's what it is, and it's just in an email exchange, but no signing was ever done, that still will hold up?
Absolutely, especially if they enforce it for other people, they provide separation monies for other people, then that provides a precedent for you to point to and say, hey, they got separation money based on that, so I should too. It's, you know, it's absolutely an enforceable right to separation pay.
Oh, you mean even if it's routine in the office, like if Kathy and Judy, not to use those two names here in WGM, but let's say Kathy and Judy were getting severance and Jenny was not, Jenny could say, wait, Kathy and Judy got severance, and I'm a similar job and I work there a similar amount of time. Why don't I get it?
Yes, and that's an enforceable, that's a practice that could be enforceable as far as separation pay goes. So if you're looking at whether you're going to get severance, do I have a written obligation on the part of the company? Could be an offer letter, a contract, even an email. Do I have is there a practice within the company of paying severance based on how long you work there or what position you're in or a combination of those things? Or do they actually have a policy? Do they have a policy in their handbook? Do they have a separate separation policy, which a lot of companies actually have? So even though, John, you may not have a right under statutory law, right, in Illinois, those three categories are ways to support your right to severance contractually. And so I have that conversation with people all the time. They go, I don't have separation pay. And then I ask them about those different places. I'm like, well, actually, they do pay people separation pay. And that could easily rise to the level of an enforceable contract for you to get severance.
312 texted, and I left my job to go to another job. My last paycheck I got from my previous company was extra 2 weeks more than I thought it would be. I did the right thing and asked the company to make sure they didn't overpay me. Turns out they paid me PTO. I had unlimited time off. I assumed that since I didn't have anything officially banked, I wasn't paid on my PTO, but they let me know they had to pay me 2 weeks' pay because we use a company policy of unlimited time off. Does that jive with what you hear, Patrick?
It does, and you know what's funny about that? Most companies don't do that. So even if a company has an unlimited PTO policy and they think, oh, you know what? That means we don't have to pay accrued unused vacation when somebody leaves. That is wrong in the state of Illinois. You need to pay 40 hours of PTO, but here's the kicker. The employee and the employer should track what the person uses. So if the person uses at least 2 weeks, then frankly, they're not going to have a right to those 2 weeks under even with an unlimited pay policy. Does that make sense?
Well, that's just what the 312 said. He said, I should have taken more time off since they had to blanket pay me that week anyways. It didn't matter. But if the company had gone back and said, no, well, actually, you used the time that we would be forced to pay you for unlimited vacation time, we can take that off the top.
Yes. And that's why it's important for employees to keep track of what they take as far as vacation goes. Even if, and really especially if, your company has an unlimited PTO policy, which frankly, John, people actually use less PTO if they have an unlimited policy because they feel like they can't. You know what I mean? So that's a really good call because most companies don't do the right thing under that scenario.
Yep. 773 said, I got fired on maternity leave. I absolutely thought that would be illegal just on its face. I talked to a different lawyer who said not necessarily, and I'm shocked. Patrick?
I think that different lawyer is right. It's not necessarily illegal, but there's a ton of questions whether, you know, what was going on before the person left for pregnancy leave? Was it a performance issue? If it was, then maybe that could support termination while they're gone. That's a very dangerous time. You could have a retaliation claim. So the company really needs to have buttoned up the reason. Is it a layoff? Is it performance that was brought to their attention before the pregnancy leave. There's a ton of questions there, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's illegal if you're terminated while you're on pregnancy leave.
Let's say you have a policy of 12 weeks paid that either they just give you, or maybe you've accrued it in short term, whatever different, like sick time overpay that they sometimes have, right? Like an extra bank.
Sure.
Let's say you only used 4 weeks of it and you got fired. Do they have to pay you the rest of the 8 weeks?
Not typically sick time, no. No.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Well,
like, you went on maternity leave thinking you've got 3 months of pay, and then they fire you. I don't even care if it's for a legit reason. They should at least have to finish paying your maternity or paternity leave.
Yeah, not if you're terminated. Most times there's no obligation in the policy to do so. But I will say, let me just add, that's a huge red flag. I think there's retaliation and discrimination concerns there, because they had more time to take and it would cost the company more. It sounds like they're just trying to get out of that obligation, which could be illegal.
630 says one of the employees at work assumed a task of a position that wasn't going to be filled. She got a raise. The same thing just happened to me. I got more tasks. I was told there was no additional compensation. Is that legal? Patrick, think about it and you'll answer it. And we'll have Mike Leonard joining us as well after the 1:30 news on Let's Get Legal on WGN. Now we got Mike Leonard joining the fray as well. Mike, how are you doing? Federal defense attorney.
Great, John. Really happy to be here. And yeah, I think Patrick's right. It's too late to invest in money for your kid, so I'm sorry. Sorry you missed the window, my friend.
I missed the first 3 weeks of investing in the
shift,
college.
You know?
Yeah. Well, that's okay. That's okay. I'll get on in here soon enough. Mike, stand by, because I have a Patrick Dolan question. And by the way, people can text in questions. We're going to call this the grab bag hour from 1:30 to 2:30. Any legal question you have, Mike Leonard and Patrick Dolan will take a swing at it, and hopefully we'll guide you in some sort of way, or at least give you some general information about the topic. Or I got a lot of lawyers at my disposal that have been on the show. I can get them a quick text and see if they can come on, whether it's an estate planning question or whatever the case may be. We'll do our best. 312-981-7200. But this one's for Patrick. One of the employees is from the 630 at this person's work. They assumed the tasks of a position that wasn't going to be filled. So essentially, they got rid of a position. They gave those responsibilities to one of this person's coworkers, and she got a raise, the coworker. The same thing just happened to me, says the 630. And they were told that there was no additional compensation. Is that legal?
It could be discrimination. Is the person a male who did not get the raise?
I don't know. I didn't ask. Well, you should have asked me that question during the news. I could have texted them follow-ups, Patrick.
You know, this is not my fault, John. Okay, this is not my fault.
So it would have to be a suspect class sort of thing.
Yeah, so it would have to be discrimination. So if it's a male, then yeah, it could be. If there's no, like, if there's no discrimination element and there's no retaliation element, I don't, you know, maybe the caller or this person complained about something and now they're given more work and not as much pay. There's a lot of questions to ask, but unless it's discrimination or retaliation or some form of harassment, it sounds like a bad business practice, but it's okay. But yeah. those are really big questions with a lot of sort of detail needed.
You ask if it's discrimination,
yeah.
Which I'm saying it could be, right?
Sure.
Maybe this person is, you mentioned a male, maybe it's a different gender. The female got the raise, the male didn't.
Yep.
Okay. How hard is it to prove a discrimination case based on one individual's circumstances, right? Like, I imagine it's easier for you if you can show a pattern. If five people came to you under the same circumstances, they belong to the same class, and they were all treated the same way, then that's one thing. The texter did just text back that they're both female, but she is, quote, way older. Which that could raise your eyebrows too, Patrick. But is it harder to prove something like this when it's a one-off?
I would say the short answer is no. I know that seems a bit counterintuitive, but most of my clients and claims on their behalves are for individuals, not groups. And I don't have any problem comparing them to somebody else outside the protected category if I believe discrimination occurred. So no, I don't think so.
If this texter, and we'll find out, is over the age of 40, which my guess would be yes, does the person who got the raise, her coworker that got the preferential treatment, have to be under 40? Or if that person's 42 and our texter's 62, is a 20 age gap difference enough, or does it literally have to be a dividing line of the people that get preferential treatment are under 40 versus the people that don't are over 40, and that's age discrimination?
Yeah, the law is pretty strict on that. You have to be over 40, and the person who's being preferred has to be under 40. There, I almost hesitate to say this. There's occasionally a rare case where somebody maybe in their 70s was treated worse than somebody in their 40s, in other words, still in that protected category, and that could constitute age discrimination. But John, almost never would that work by filing a claim with the EEOC.
I feel like the spread is more important than the specific age limit. Like, I turned 40 last summer. Are you telling me that if someone at one of the places I worked was 39 and got preferential treatment versus me at 40 in a couple days, I could have had a lawsuit? But if I was 65 and treated poorly compared to someone that was 45, I don't have a case?
Yes. There's your short answer, yes.
I know they have to have lines in the sand.
There has to be. I mean, but all those protected categories have to have lines. It's easier with gender or race or religion or, you know, disability or sexual orientation.
Well, why don't you say 40 is the line in the sand, or and add an addendum to the law if there's a gap of more than 13 years or something like that?
Well, that sounds like something you should take up, John.
I am going to take that up. Mike Leonard, you with me in this case?
Well, John, I think your hypothetical is flawed because you're an old 40. So, you know, it kind of depends where you fall on the continuum, my friend.
Well, you're a young 78, so.
Wow. Thank you, John.
All right. Well, any more questions, bring them on in. 312-981-7200 in the employment law world. I want to ask you, Mike Leonard, you and I have talked about the changes in the new administration in the past, and we don't get too political on the show at all. In fact, we try and stay more on the legal sphere of things. But since you are a federal defense attorney, I imagine, well, first let me ask you, do you interact with federal prosecutors all that much, or is there like a line in the of demarcation between the two camps?
Well, all the time. I mean, in terms of case-specific stuff, you have lots of interactions over time.
Friendly relationships at the bar, stuff like that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can have those. You can have those friendly relationships, too. Personally, I don't do a lot of that, and probably because they don't want to hang out with me. There's nothing wrong with that, and it's not exactly like TV where, you know, you have your trial day. On TV, in the movies, always you have your trial day, and then you're both sitting next to you at the bar having your drink, talking about a case. That never happens, okay?
Oh, really? Okay.
And then after your case is over, it typically doesn't happen because someone wins and someone loses, and so you don't really feel like doing that after the trial either. But yeah, there's certainly social occasions where prosecutors and defense lawyers mix all sorts of, you know, bar-related functions. I don't mean bar drinking, but, you know, right, bar associations, all sorts of stuff. So yeah, there's certainly a camaraderie amongst the criminal defense bar and the prosecutorial bar to some degree, for sure.
I was just wondering, has there been any scuttlebutt about, you know, obviously our federal prosecutors now, they now work for a new attorney general and a new Department of Justice that has certainly been in the news in recent days. Again, agree or disagree with the administration, it certainly has been a tumultuous couple of weeks. And some people would say, good, that's by design. They want to change how things have operated over the past. You know, I'll leave that opinion to the listener. But have you heard any scuttlebutt from federal prosecutors about how the new edicts have kind of gone over?
Well, I think in general, I mean, I think there's some backlash against some of the edicts, if you're calling them, in terms of the focus of the U.S. Attorney's offices throughout the country. Yeah, there's definitely a certain backlash, and it's caused a lot of people to resign their positions, not necessarily so in Chicago. Chicago does now have a new interim U.S. attorney that was just recently named, Andrew Boutros. And so he used to work for that office as a line prosecutor, so he's the new U.S. attorney, at least on an interim basis here. So that's a big issue, big change.
And what's his
right?
job then? What does that role mean?
Well, you're the chief prosecutor for the entire office, right?
Okay.
So every U.S. attorney's office, including Chicago, has a, you know, a name and face to the office who guides policy and is the top him or her in the office, so to speak. And so, as you know, people like Patrick Fitzgerald, other people like that, Jim Thompson, have held that position over the years. And so they're kind of the public face to the office in terms of prosecutions.
Do you feel like, for the most part, even when there's big national headlines about certain decisions that the DOJ is making or not making, that still at a very local level, that most of the U.S. attorneys, regardless of which president appointed them, they get down to the business of the people and they work well with other federal prosecutors under them that may have different political leanings? You kind of see what I'm getting at?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think where the politics comes into is the focus of what kind of cases are encouraged to be brought. You know, for example, in the Trump administration, we're going to see a lot more, in my view, you know, street crimes that could be charged at the state level, charged more frequently at the federal level, and then a de-emphasis on white-collar criminal cases. And, you know, they're reviewing a lot of cases. You know, one of the interesting issues that came up this week is the ComEd 4 bribery case, right, that we've talked so much about over the last couple of years. The Department of Justice has told prosecutors that they're reviewing that case, meaning that they could make the decision that to essentially, you know, take action to obviate the verdict, you know, that they could say, oh, gee, you know, it's not a case we should have tried. It could be, you know, who knows what could happen, but they're reviewing that case which already went to trial. And so, you know, things like that, those broad policy decisions do have, you know, immediate effects upon offices throughout the country because they know what kind of cases are supposed to be brought and they're going to decline to bring some cases they don't want to bring. So it can have a huge effect on prosecutions across the country. There's no doubt.
My initial reaction is I can't believe a prosecutor could kind of do that. But wait, we talk about that all the time with criminal cases and where prosecutors learn more information and toss the previous charges. It's within their power, right?
Yeah, and then also we have a very, you know, aggressive use of pardoning people by the Trump administration or other tools where you can reduce the sentence. There was a guy who was convicted in federal court in New York who was facing like 10 years, and he basically got a walk away from the Trump administration Department of Justice this past week. So clearly it can have an enormous effect for your client in sometimes positive, sometimes negative ways.
And, of course, President Biden, of course, with a lot of pardons as well in his last couple of days. I just want to mention that as well, in fairness. 630, this is for Patrick Dolan. And, Warren, we're going to get to you after the commercial break. 630, Patrick Dolan, I worked at a major hospital. When I retired in 2016, I had accumulated sick and PTO time, and I was not paid any recourse. My question here is, I know that there's a delineation between sick and PTO. Patrick, is there also a delineation between fired, let go versus retiring? Does that change the calculus on what a company has to pay you?
Maybe in terms of sick, but no, not in terms of PTO. PTO, accrued unused, gets paid out regardless of the reason for departure. And you have several years typically to file that PTO claim because it's considered a wage, right? In Illinois has an incredibly long statute of limitations, 10 years to file a wage claim. And wages are broadly defined. So, but if you talk about sick time, John, you have to look at the policy, which is typically not paid out. PTO has to be. So those are very different things.
If it was back in 2016, are we past the point in which someone could do something about it?
No. I mean, it's 25, so no, I don't think so. I'm happy to talk with them, but no. And by the way, the penalties are stiff over the years. I mean, it's that Illinois wage statute has a lot of accumulating monthly interest that compounds, attorney's fees, has a lot of good damage elements to it that over time, that number can grow to a much, much bigger number.
All right, I'm going to tell the texter to call you Monday, okay?
Sure.
312-332-7800 is how you reach Patrick Dolan. Man, 9 years in the past, get that accumulated PTO time.
It's going to be a lot.
It's going to be a lot of money. All right, do that. And call us right now, 312-91-7200. That's where Warren is waiting. He'll wait a little bit longer. We're going to get to a commercial break here on Let's Get Legal on WGN. 151 on WGN. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Patrick Dolan, employment lawyer. Michael Leonard, federal defense attorney. All of us together, we are tackling all your questions. I will try not to weigh in as I am not a lawyer, although I like to play one on the radio sometimes.
I forget you're not a lawyer, John. You really seem like a lawyer to me.
Oh,
Mike,
what
do you think?
He's not.
I thought he
was.
Didn't he pass the bar?
Are you sure?
Did you go to law school?
I know
you guys
done with your little comedy.
He's never.
Like
he's never passed a bar. Let's face that.
Oh, hello, hello to that.
I always go right inside. Is what you're saying?
Yes, John.
Sorry, John. Do you have a question for us?
I don't, but Warren does. He is on line one. Warren, you've got a comment or a question for our guests?
Yeah, but I certainly thank you for taking the call. I certainly respect the authority of the judges, and you know what they say goes. But in a situation where perhaps a client feels the judge is being unreasonable and the attorney agrees, what happens? Or, you know, is the defendant just stuck and they have to sort of take it? Or Or what happens?
That's an interesting question, right? Like, if a judge seems to be out of line, and I've listened to and seen many stories of people feeling like a judge was completely out of line in certain circumstances. Mike Leonard, is that just an appeals situation? Is there anything you do in the moment?
Well, first of all, let's just find out, are any judges listening?
If they are,
they're all reasonable.
Yeah, all reasonable.
Careful, I respect the authority of the judges, and what the defendant thinks doesn't matter.
Oh, so do we. So do we. That's why I want to make sure, when I'm in court this week, that no one's listening, because I've never heard of an unreasonable judge. That's got to be like a unicorn. No, but it does arise in many different contexts. We saw Warren's question on the screen, Patrick and I, during the break. So, it can come up in a variety of contexts in terms of reasonability about setting the schedule for the case, setting the trial date, how the judge treats the litigant, how the judge treats lawyers, how the judge treats lawyers in front of a jury. So there's all sorts of ways that this issue can come up. First of all, in state court, you have a chance to substitute judge, file an SOJ motion. So if you have a particular bad experience with a judge, or you don't think they're going to be good for your case or your client, you could actually exercise that strike and get a different judge in federal court.
That's before the trial?
No, that's before they've ruled on anything that's substantive. Meaning,
okay,
if they've already heard, you can't dip your toe in the water, so to speak. So if they've ruled on anything that's considered substantive in any way whatsoever, it's too late to make that motion for change of judge. Of course, if there was, misconduct involved or something like that, that would be, something that would open the door for such a motion, but that's extraordinarily rare. In federal court, you don't get that option. You don't get to substitute judge. You get assigned to the judge you have, and, but for an extraordinary circumstance, that's going to be the judge that you have for the case. So I guess Warren's question, more practically comes up during the case, during the course of litigation. There are certain circumstances, maybe I've been involved or just heard about, we won't tip our hand here, where, the judge was acting in a manner which did cause the parties to believe that there was a bias or something like that. You certainly can raise that, but sometimes at your peril. And, it's very difficult on appeal to prove that a judge had any sort of bias or prejudice against your client, absent some sort of really black and white statement that's made. So it's a tough one. And I think, it's just like common sense. Sometimes you have to push back against people you think are being unfair to you. And let's face it, it happens in any area of life, and it can happen in court. And so you have to sort of navigate. Do you push back hard? Do you push back, off the record? You have to kind of be strategic about it, because ultimately your end game is to do the best you can for your client rather than make yourself feel good. Patrick, what do you think?
Well, I think that's a good answer. I'll put it in a really fine point. There's really not much, if anything, you can do after the case has been going on for a while. If you think your judge is being biased, you just don't agree. You can't get rid of that judge. It would have to be extreme action for you to be able to do that. So Mike's right. I mean, you just frankly massage it the best you can, and pick those arguments frankly and make them in a way that you're hoping has no retribution on your client. But practically speaking, there's very little you can do during the course of litigation.
I love the randomness of how judges are selected too, even federally. We saw this story come out yesterday, a really contentious Wisconsin Supreme Court race. Mm-hmm. And Judge Susan Crawford is running against Brad Schimmel, and Elon Musk is pouring a lot of money into the campaign and, in fact, giving away million-dollar prizes, and people are contending that maybe that's illegal. Anyways, there's a lawsuit against Elon Musk and what he is doing to try and beat Susan Crawford, the judge, and she got picked to be the judge for that case because it's a random assignment for the court. And obviously, and rightfully so, she has recused herself for that, rightfully so. But again, it just goes to show that you never know exactly how the wheel spins and which judge you're going to get. I'm sure, Mike Leonard, you've experienced that too. We don't have time for you to respond right now, though. Warren, thank you for the phone call. Mike, I'll give you another chance to comment on what I just said, and Patrick Dolan too. And any more questions that you have, 312-981-7200.
You're listening to Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association, with host John Hansen. Today's show is sponsored by attorney Michael Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers and attorney Patrick Dolan from Conti and Dolan. Now, here's John Hansen, and let's get legal.
At 210 on WGN. Man, I like that pump-up music we got. I think they added a little tones of rock underneath because we got Mike Leonard and Patrick Dolan in studio today. Gentlemen, thank you for hopping on in for our grab bag of legal questions. We got one question that I did not want you guys just to guess on because you really are very limited both in what you guys know in the law.
Wow.
To your own scopes and your own field.
Why do we come on the show?
I don't know.
Like, let's go. Should we just
because you, just like me, look, love the sound of your own voice. No, don't pretend like you don't.
Not as much as you, John. To be
John, I have a proposition for us.
Okay.
Will you consider this?
Yeah, wow.
You're the judge on the show, as we all know, and we've been told over and over. How about we get to answer the question that we allegedly don't know anything about, and then you have the right answer by Dave Schluter, and then if we're right, we're geniuses.
You know what? That sounds like it takes way too long to do. I think I'll just let Dave answer it, and then you guys can say afterwards, ditto.
It's a little attitude today, Mike.
All right, guys. All right, pause your thoughts. Let's get Tom on the line. Tom's probably about to hang up if he doesn't get answered soon. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
No. I'm enjoying your show. I have no problem with that.
Okay, great. Tom, before you get your question, Dave Schluter, you're on the line too, right, buddy?
Yeah, I'm all here, yep.
Dave does a lot of estate planning, real estate law. He's a great man. And I had to call him because, Tom, I wanted to make sure I got an expert opinion. What is your question, Tom?
You have a foster child, and a will is made out by the foster father in 2005, leaving everything to the foster child. The wife dies. As the years go by, the father finds a girlfriend.
Okay.
In 2015... he makes a new will, which says I give half to my girlfriend companion and half to my foster son.
Okay.
The man dies. The son has the original 2005 will, and the girlfriend has a Xerox of the 2014 will.
Not the original.
Not the original. So, and you know, the usual is I hereby revoke all prior wills and codicils by me made. But how would the Xerox of a subsequent will affect the original older will?
An interesting question, Dave. I don't know if Xerox copies aren't as feasible or allowed in a court, or if they would look and say the guy clearly wanted to split his assets between his girlfriend and his foster son. Any initial thoughts on all that, Dave?
The presumption under Illinois law is that the person must have changed their mind and destroyed the original, meaning they're back to the original will. Now, what should happen is whoever's got that will, since the dad died, should go ahead and get that filed in the county where he is a resident of. That starts the meter running. But again, every day people change their mind. They either burn them or they shred them. And that's the presumption starts out that the reason they can't find it is he did change his mind. It's not 100%, but that's the starting point under the law.
Wait, I want to make sure I understand. You're saying that I just want to make sure I understand. I'm confused. The presumption is he must have changed his mind if the original can't be found, meaning the Xerox copy is not valid.
And there are people who've gotten Xerox copies admitted. A couple of colleagues of mine have, but it's quite an ordeal. The formalities of the will have to be addressed by the judge. Witnesses, notary, and all that. People have to give testimony of the circumstances. It's definitely an uphill battle. It has happened in Illinois where someone has actually got it in. Think about people in California where everything got burned to the ground, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what an injustice if, you know, nothing. When it can't be, there's circumstances where it isn't there for a very good reason. But the starting point is the person, it would have been locatable if in fact it could be located by her. I don't know if they locked her out of the house and that's why she couldn't find it or whatever. There's all kinds of goofy circumstances. But the issue is it starts out that the other one's going to prevail.
Wow, interesting. So just, and obviously things can be proven differently, like you're saying, extenuating circumstances. But the presumption is if they don't find, with just a general look about where a will would be, if they don't find that original will, just generally speaking, the court, the law in Illinois thinks, well, that was destroyed for some reason, and now we revert back to the original will, which we have a copy of, which is valid. I just want to make sure I understand that before I go to
town. The original love, yeah. And so they could act on that and get rolling on that. Sooner the better. You know, notice can be given out. Hear ye, there's going to be a hearing on this will. And knock yourself out if you think you can come in on the date certain and prove otherwise. Once it gets admitted, then pretty much a notice goes out through the nearest legal bulletin. We use the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin here in Chicago. And it says, by the way, an estate has been opened by George Schwartz, who's the named executor. If you think you've got a beef in that estate or you want to jump in, you've got 6 months to come in. Otherwise, if you don't do anything, we're going to keep moving. But, yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I have families where the mom or dad were kind of private people. Once in a while, it ends up in a safety deposit box, and then we have to actually get a court order to drill the box. We probate the safety deposit box because mom was so private, she never brought anybody in to the bank. Huh. But I've had to do that two or three times in my now almost 40-year career where the judge gets a court order and they drill the box and there's the will or there's the life insurance policy or whatever they need to get urgently. But, yeah, it's a great question.
Tom, did that satisfy your answer?
It did to some extent. My question was kind of centering on you do have some evidence of I revoke all prior wills and codicils made. So if that worrying would revoke the 2005 will.
No, that's only if it's proven to be. There's only going to be one will eventually that the court will administrate. So if, in fact, got that copy in. No, right now that language in a photocopy alone, it is in every will because people change their wills. That's why it says I revoke all my past ones.
Right.
But the wording in a copy is not going to have as much leverage as you might think.
Well, what I was getting at was at one point the second quote-unquote original was signed, which would have been the death knell for the first will.
If the original was found, Tom.
They're right. But if the second original is not found, then the first will rises like a phoenix from the ashes.
Generally speaking, that seems to be the case, right, Dave?
Yeah, right, exactly. If it was not destroyed. If it was destroyed, then whoever's relying on that is SOL. But right now, it sounds like your whoever your acquaintance is has the original in their hands, and they should hang on to that and get that filed in the circuit court immediately. It's
original,
not a probate case, but it's a will filing. Mm-hmm.
The will is filed in Will County. So
all right,
there you go.
Thanks, Tom.
The meter's running, and I'm sure they've got a good attorney. So
all right, thank you, Tom. We appreciate it. Hey, Dave, that was a great question, by the way. Dave, WGNattorney.com. How can people reach you, my friend?
Yeah, at that domain or 630-285-5300. We always take calls for consults. That's just the way we market ourselves. But, yeah, we're very fair. We enjoy what we do. And right now it's 69 at O'Hare Brothers, so that's near me. So
love
so
that.
We're having fun out here.
Thanks for jumping on with us, Dave. You're kind of my go-to on all this stuff. I appreciate it. That's Dave Schluter, WGNattorney.com. I don't know if I would have guessed that, Patrick and Mike. I thought maybe the photocopy signed would be admissible in some way, shape, or form.
No, Mike. Yeah, Mike and I were chatting about that. Dave's entirely correct with that answer.
Yeah, I think Dave got it right. Yeah, hats off to Dave.
We were nodding.
It's kind of an easy one.
Yeah,
kind of an easy one, but nice work, Dave.
Okay, well, waiting patiently is Frank. Frank has an employment law question, I believe. Frank, go ahead.
Hey, how are you all today? You sound great.
Doing great, thank you.
My question is, I work for a company that is paid by commission only, and some days I don't get paid at all. And I'm wondering, is there a law that can protect me from not getting paid at all? Because I do company work. And my question, I looked it up, and it seemed like there was a new law passed in Illinois in 2025. I'm not sure. That was my question.
When you say you do company work, you mean towards the promotion of your sales, right? Or is it other company work assigned?
It could be the promotion of somebody's sales the next day. It might not be somebody who, unless I'm working the next day, to prop somebody up for the next day, potentially.
Interesting. Patrick, thoughts?
So commission, yeah. So first of all, anybody on a commission only pay plan, I mean, that's legal as long as a person's making minimum wage, and it's not a daily thing, right? I mean, you have to.
Wait. What do you mean by making minimum wage? Meaning that at the end of the day, that paycheck must reflect minimum wage of 40 hours.
Yes. 40 hours. Okay. Two things. So you're paid every other week, right? You need to make minimum wage for the hours that you work, even if you're on a commission only pay plan. No matter what, no matter how you're paid, you must be paid minimum wage in Illinois. Right. So I'm not sure if he was or wasn't. That's number one. Number two, the commission plan will outline how you're paid, the triggering event for your right to be paid. But it has to be paid within typically a couple of weeks after that triggering event has occurred. Maybe it's a close of a sale. There are a couple different ways that can trigger payment obligation to someone under a commission plan. And the company doesn't have very long, usually, you know, a couple of weeks under the law to pay someone that commission. So you have two issues. Are they paid minimum wage? And pursuant to the pay plan, when do they have that vested right to the commission monies? And you need to be paid within a couple of weeks after that.
Here's a question before I go back to Frank. Frank, let me interrupt one second just to make sure I understand. Let's say he has a sale on the first day of the 2 week period, right? Or the trigger event has happened and he's paid enough that would actually cover 2 weeks of minimum wage, but he continues to work on basic other things and he gets to the end of those 2 weeks. Are you saying he should get the sale, the commission amount, and the minimum wage for the other subsequent 9 days of work? Or since he made that sale and that was greater than minimum wage for the 10 days of work, that sale alone is what he can be paid for?
It's the second one. So long as you're paid minimum wage for the time worked when you're paid, then that's the thing that you have to be concerned about.
Okay, Frank, go ahead.
Two questions. What is minimum wage? Did it just go up? What is minimum wage?
It depends where you are. It's like 14 or 15. I don't know exactly.
It's right around 14 or 15.
Yeah, right around 14 or 15 in the city of Chicago.
Okay, and what if I'm not paid that?
What if
after 2 weeks, my pay reflecting my hours does not equal minimum wage?
Yeah, then they violated the law, frankly. So if you do the math and figure out how many hours you worked, if you're not paid minimum wage, then that's a violation of Illinois law.
Okay. And would that include tips as well? For instance, is the tips included in the commission amount?
So you have a tip. You're partly paid by tip as part of the commission. Is that what you're saying?
No. I do. I get. Well, I don't know. I get commission and I get tips. Calculating the minimum wage. I compare it to the commission plus the tips, or just the commission?
No. The tip will go toward the calculation of the minimum wage.
Okay. So
I think you need to follow up with Patrick and show him some numbers, Frank.
Yeah, we need to see numbers, but generally speaking, the tip is part of your wage and it goes toward the minimum wage calculation.
But it's a really good question.
Let me know how to get in touch with Patrick, because I'd like to follow up on this.
Oh, I will absolutely do that. You got a pen near you, Frank?
Sure, yep.
And I'll read this a couple more times before he leaves and gets out of here. It's 312-332-7800. You could tattoo that to your forearm, Frank, like I have done, as Patrick Mamie, as part of his contract with WGN.
Sorry, on my play.
Yeah, 312-332-7800. Thanks, Frank. That's a great call.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for answering my question. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Frank.
Patrick, a lot of commission-based things must be.
Yeah, a lot.
Desk,
I get questions all the time about commission plans.
312-981-7200 is how you can reach me. Now, Mike mentioned that he has a hypothetical that you two wanted to discuss with me.
It's a good one. Go ahead, Mike.
We did. So we're talking about the concept of an alibi witness. So, for example, you have a criminal trial, and the defendant contends that, hey, you know, I didn't do it because I wasn't there. I was here, right? And so typically then, of course, you're going to call the defendant to testify to that, but also the alibi witnesses say, yeah, the person was with me here. Exactly. So Patrick made a very interesting point, which I got to say I haven't heard before. So that either makes it a tremendous genius point or really dumb. I don't know.
Or you just really have missed a lot as a defense attorney.
Exactly. So we're going to ask you... And maybe listeners can chime in.
So he's going to judge whether I'm an I'm an idiot, or it was a really good question.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah. I'm nervous. I'm nervous.
Well, yeah, of course.
Abbott and Costello, let's get to the point.
The question would be, how are you going to assess the credibility of the alibi witness? Patrick made a very interesting point. He would be looking for cues from the lawyer who's questioning the alibi witness, the person who says, hey, the defendant was with me at the time of the crime. He said he would get clues, and he could draw inferences from how the attorney is, their facial expressions, their demeanor, etc., of how they're questioning the witness. I thought it was a really interesting point.
Well, let me wait, Patrick. Are you looking for like cues that it's been a coached and rehearsed little
I assume it's all coached and rehearsed. So, for example, in this hypothetical, the alibi witness was his girlfriend. Okay, I know what she's going to say. He was with me. We were watching TV, eating a pizza, whatever. Right, and prosecutor's going to try to pick it apart. I follow that, but I am really looking at the lawyer to determine whether he or she thinks that witness is credible. Because as a lawyer, I know you play the game sometimes and try to help out your client, but I would be watching Mike ask her questions. That's my point. Really focused on the lawyer.
I assume that a jury can use whatever inferences they want to determine whether someone is credible or not. I wouldn't go that far because the defense attorney is not the one on the stand.
Well, I'm looking at both. I just told Mike I would pay attention to him as well as that alibi witness.
Okay. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing that. I just think it's weird.
That's my time up.
Because Mike has a fidget. We've all known his fidget that he does. He winks a lot accidentally.
He starts laughing.
He starts laughing uncontrollably. Yeah, it's really not good. And maybe
rolls
that's
his
why
eyes.
He's lost so many cases in federal court. I'm just kidding, Mike. Mike, by the way, what number can people reach you at before we take this break?
Yeah, 312-380-6559.
One more time.
312-380-6559.
Put that number in your phone under defense attorney. You don't even need to put Mike in there. You don't need to know his name when you call him. But that defense attorney Mike in your cell phone works. Employment lawyer Patrick or Patrick Employment or Patrick Dolan, whatever you want to put in your phone, 312-332-7800. Patrick, I think you're waving goodbye to us, and Mike's hanging on for the next half hour.
That sounds right. Good to be with you, John.
Thanks so much.
Good to see you, Patrick.
720 WGN, John Hanson here. Got another half hour of Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. We've waved goodbye to Patrick Dolan, employment lawyer, and we keep Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney, in the studio. And Mike, the 847 says the jabs between Mike and Patrick have slowly been replaced by digs from John. I hope you all aren't insulted by my many digs at you two.
We're really upset, John. We wanted to talk what we call in court, we call it ex parte, meaning outside the presence of the jury. So when the listeners aren't listening, we're going to talk about this. No, we love it. It's great. It's great. Good natured banter. I think it makes for a lot of fun. We never get upset when you, wrongfully insult us, and nor do you when we attack you.
No, exactly. That's the kind of relationship we have. People should see the group text if they really want to see what happens between the three of us. That's where we can't share too many of those details. Although lately it's just been me sending pictures of my kid and Patrick's going, aw. Mike, you haven't chimed in enough about how cute my son is, so you could do that right now if you'd like.
Oh, beautiful. I always do.
I know.
I don't respond as timely as Patrick, but yeah, I think the baby is just absolutely beautiful.
Well, that's because you're busy working, and Patrick, he doesn't go to trial.
Yeah, that guy's got nothing going on. I don't know how he claims he's got all these clients calling him all the time. He's not doing anything.
I hope
he's not listening either.
No, I'm sure he is. I'm sure he'll call into Iridian here pretty soon. I heard you told Patrick when you guys were chatting during the break that you actually visited jail this morning to visit with a client. What is that like? Like, when are you able to go to visit your clients that are incarcerated? Does it make doing your job much harder? I'm sure that's why you argue maybe to get pretrial release. Walk us through that.
Yeah, it really depends upon where the case is pending. So we'll just take Chicago as a perfect example. So if you have a client who's in federal court and they're in custody, they could be at a variety of places. I mean, the traditional one is the MCC, which is the federal jail downtown Chicago, right near the courthouse. However, your client could also be in a federal case. They could be housed in Kankakee, which is a good, for me, about 50-minute drive each way, and could be much longer depending on traffic. And sometimes your client can be in various other locations. Those are kind of the two biggies, either downtown or Kankakee. And so they present their own challenges just getting in. However, unlike maybe you see on TV, there are hours, right? So, for example, MCC Chicago, if you're an attorney, typically you'd have to go between 8:30 or 9 a.m. till 3, and then they'd let you in again from 5 to 8 if you wanted to, you know, visit one or more clients.
I assume that they're doing standard things during those other hours, that they're trying to keep some order into what's happening in the flow of people at the prison?
Yeah, there's just all sorts. First of all, there's lots of people there, and so they have to manage having family visitation time, right, at certain hours. And, you know, you actually have a different area you go to. Then also there's a special unit at the MCC Chicago called the SHU, which is extraordinarily difficult on your client. It's basically being in segregation, essentially, mm-hmm. right? Being in lockdown, where you're essentially in a cell 8x8 for about 23 hours a day. Can you imagine doing that? I can't, even though I've been there many, many times. So that is really a difficult way to be in custody, especially since you haven't gone to trial yet, typically. Sometimes you're there still after your trial's over, but think about the fact that you're presumed innocent. You might be in custody 23 hours a day by yourself with very little to do.
Who determines that from a federal level? I know we've had the debate, obviously, about here in the state about pretrial detention and how that works at a state level. Who does it from the federal? Is it federal judges that make these decisions about who's detained or not?
Yeah, so one of the two things that happen at your initial appearances are, you know, setting conditions of release or not, right? And so sometimes you have that, you know, we still call it a bond hearing, but we sometimes have that at the first appearance in federal court. Other times you'll set it for a hearing maybe a few days down the line or the next week, and your client will be in custody during that time, you know, until you have the hearing. And so in federal court, the two biggest issues, which are kind of the same no matter where you are in state court or federal court, the two big issues are always risk of flight and danger to the community. And so you have someone who chimes in from what's called pretrial services and does a kind of little report, a mini report about the person's background, criminal history, the nature of the offense. You know, is there an appropriate place they could live? Is there a person who could sort of oversee them if they get out? But ultimately, you know, the judge will take that into consideration, but the judge is going to make their own decision. Is this person going to get released or not? Typically, there's a presumption that you should get released. However, certain type of crimes have a presumption the other way, meaning that you should be detained. So oftentimes, one of the big, you know, battles is your client going to be detained or not? And as you can imagine, every client I've ever met does not want to be detained. So that's right. A first battle you have in court, kind of sometimes the first chance you have to prove yourself to your client. And if you get them out, that's huge. Oftentimes, it's a great start to the relationship, great start to the case. If you don't, sometimes that makes things more difficult as you go along, because no one wants to be in custody typically while their case is pending.
Are your conversations when you visit them in jail completely private?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, if you go to one of the federal jails, you'll have an attorney visitation room. So you're face-to-face, a couple feet away. Nothing can be taped. Nothing can be monitored. You know, and none of that stuff can happen. So it's completely private. And, obviously that helps the attorney-client relationship, and it should. You should never be able to know what the attorney is saying to the client. We did have a real interesting incident one time. We were in a federal court case in St. Louis, and the person was in jail, like literally almost an hour away. So just to see the person during the trial, like let's say the trial day ends at 5, you wanted to go see your client, you'd have to drive out an hour each way just to prepare them for the next day or talk about what happened in the trial that day. And the weirdest thing happened where they didn't have any audio, right? But they did have video monitoring of our visit. They could actually see us on a video thing. Mm-hmm. And we had them, this is so bizarre, it's almost unheard of, but the person who was watching the video, first of all, you're allowed to bring your computer into the room as an attorney. So you'd have authorization to bring your computer. And you could also actually, you could have your cell phone in there too. You couldn't let your client use your cell phone, and you couldn't be on your cell phone, but you could have that. And the person, whoever was watching the videotape, claimed that they thought our client had picked up a cell phone at some point during the meeting, which had never happened. It had not happened.
Like you had handed off a cell phone somehow?
No, that just that they picked it up off the ground or something like that, which was 100% completely false, never happened. And the prosecution was attempting to bar us from having visitations with the client during the trial. We went crazy because, first of all, it never happened. And secondly, it was unbelievable that they were sort of micromanaging our visitations and seemingly watching us. So
you went in the court the next day and they raised an objection saying, hey, we heard that this had happened in the client visit. They shouldn't be able to visit again.
Yeah. And we were up in arms. The judge agreed with us wholeheartedly, said that's not happening. But the amazing thing was, you know, it just didn't even happen, which was, you know, the crazy part, you know, so you're being, your client's essentially being accused of something that never occurred. And you got federal prosecutors telling a judge that, you know, they should limit your ability to interact with your client during a trial, which I thought was crazy and absurd. And that's sometimes you have to fight real hard, John, against the evil empire, which are the prosecutors.
When I walk by MCC every time and I look up at those really thin windows, you might be knowing exactly where I'm going here, Mike. But I just remember the escape in 2012. Of the two cellmates and sheets on down. You remember that?
I remember it really well. That was insane. I don't know if all your listeners are aware of this, but it's about 10 years ago or so, 10 to 15 years ago.
2012.
And two guys, they basically, if you've ever walked by the MCC Chicago, the windows are extraordinarily thin. They're like on an angle, and you could not imagine anyone getting out of there. But somehow they had like chipped around the, you know, the facade of the window, but you still... extremely small space, and then used bed sheets to like a great movie, John, to get all the way down
to help tie it.
Yeah, to get all the way down to almost to the ground. And I think it was about 5 a.m. when they were getting away, which is kind of hard to believe that nobody saw this going on, right?
Yeah, they went onto the parking deck on Van Buren, and then they hailed a cab.
Yeah, which is just hilarious. Like, no one asked any questions. Like, hey, why are you guys wearing those uniforms and those shoes? But sadly or unsadly, they were, like most escapees, caught rather quickly, because it seems like anytime someone escapes, they always go to their girlfriend's house or their wife's house or their best friend's house and are caught within, you know, 72 hours. So it was miraculous that it ever happened, and probably will never, ever happen there again, because I'm sure they've taken a lot of steps to make sure that no one gets through that window again, John.
I pulled up an article that was written 10 years later. Yeah, one of the guys was caught 2 days later, hiding in an apartment in Lincoln Park, a few doors down from his childhood home. The other one was on the loose for 18 days before he was found in a basement boiler room of a Palos Hills apartment complex, disguised as an old man. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you view this, they are now at the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado, where they ain't getting out there.
Yeah, probably was not worth the consequences that came about, because that probably were not worth it.
Yeah, that's a wild story. Let's take a break, Mike Leonard. We'll have a few more. And if you got questions, 312-981-7200. Mike's got a lot of stories to tell. He's represented a lot of people. He's won a lot of cases against the federal government, which doesn't happen all that often. 720 WGN, John Hansen here, Mike Leonard here as well, federal defense attorney. And we've been chatting through your visits sometimes to visit your clients when they're in jail. Am I using the right nomenclature? What is the jail between, what difference between jail and prison, Mike?
Yeah, so jail
where you
means,
go first.
What's that?
Jail's where you go first, right?
Yeah, jail is where you're awaiting trial, or sometimes you have had your trial, but you're awaiting sentencing or post-trial motions. Prison is when you're actually serving a period of incarceration because you have either pled guilty or been found guilty.
So usually you're chatting with people in jail, although I guess in appeals and stuff you might be going to prison to visit them. Do you see these visits that you have to do with them? Obviously, you're going to talk about the case or what you're doing for them. Do you, and the 773 was kind of wondering the same thing, do you almost have to kind of like pump up your client a little bit, put them in a good mood? Do you feel like that's part of your responsibility? This might be the one time of the day or the week they get to chat with anyone that's not in jail with them. You see what I'm asking?
100% true. For example, one of my recent visits was to someone who is in, you know, essentially isolation segregation. So to be able to, you know, interact with another human being and have a conversation about anything, you know, whether it could be sports, current events, that's huge. And that's definitely part of your visit. It's not just a, hey, let's talk about your case. You know, you can talk about your case endlessly, but, you know, sometimes not. But part of the benefit of that visit, not only just establishing a relationship and maintaining the relationship, is oftentimes just it's a break from the unbelievable monotony or sometimes incredibly horrible conditions they're in before they've even gone to trial. So if you imagine if you're in lockdown 23 hours a day, you're going to welcome a visit from anybody. and be able to talk about any subject you want. So we do cover a lot of things that have absolutely nothing to do with the case, from personal life to, you know, what's going on in the world, what's going on in the news, what happened in the game, because they're not getting any of that, you know. I mean, they're actually getting, they do get radio and they do get the show, John. So
good.
Must be a good boost for you. So imagine if you weren't getting any TV at all and you're not getting the newspaper and you really don't know what's going on around you. It's definitely fun and, you know, helps your mind work when you can find out, you know, some other things that are happening outside of that 8x8.
Well, then I'm curious here, and we're about to get a little deep here, Mike. I'm sure you don't mind. You and I have chatted about, and we get a lot of questions when you come on, or certainly in your first couple appearances. How can you defend some of the criminals of our country that have done sometimes heinous things? And we've often talked about, well, everyone deserves a defense, and having a strong defense system in place ensures that perhaps the day that you get arrested for something you didn't do, or you're being over-targeted or something, that system then works for your benefit. That's how this all has to work. And I think most people can wrap their heads around that. But Mike, when it comes down to, like you're saying, you want to be nice, you want to like be personable with these people who are dealing with really difficult things. And I know everyone in the system right now that you're dealing with, most of them are innocent until proven guilty. But like, do you ever like feel like you've, I don't know, crossed a line? Or do you feel like even being jovial is just part of your job of being a good lawyer? Do you sometimes form bonds with people that you would maybe consider some folks friends at a certain point? You see how, like, what I'm saying, that it crosses over when you're talking about doing lawyerly things to also like updating them on the tournament, you know?
Oh yeah. I mean, look, it's like any kind of relationship. So I know I kind of get the point, but no matter what line of work you're in, you know, you're still going to have all these types of relationships, right? And, you know, just because you're in sales, for example, you're not going to love everyone you interact with or think they're great people, but you're going to have a relationship with them more or less, right? And you're going to talk about all sorts of stuff. And then being a criminal defense lawyer, you have a unique opportunity to get to know people on a very intimate level that you would never, you know, otherwise interact with in life, probably. And absolutely, you have good relationships with not every single person, but you know, it goes beyond just the law, because you know they're a sounding board for a lot of different things, and you're going to discuss a lot of different things. You're going to get to know their whole life in a way that you're not going to get probably to know people in other lines of work. You might, but you get to know them at a very deep level oftentimes. And so you definitely form bonds. You definitely have good feelings about them later. And you can think of all sorts of clients that you would love to run into and talk to and see how they're doing, because you have formed that bond, which is forged through probably one of the greatest hardships of their life. So it would make sense you would have, there'd be some closest relationship.
Yeah, I think it's, you have a unique job where I think a lot of us who maybe don't interact with people who are going to trial, a lot of us see things in black and white, right? If you're there, you did something wrong, or you're a bad person versus a good person. But like, I think of just like, Mike, you represented a January 6th defendant, and you've someone who's come on the show and thought that some of the behavior at the Capitol, I'm not saying your defendant specifically, but you called out some of the actions at the Capitol for being wrong, and then you had to defend, and you wanted to defend and help defend a January 6er. It just points to the complexities of life and how nothing is so black and white. Usually, most things are not black and white. There's a lot of gray area, and I imagine that makes you a more well-rounded lawyer in person.
I hope so. I mean, but just think about it this way. I mean, anybody's sister, brother, mother, uncle, aunt, friend, you know, that they know from some aspect of their life, and they find themselves in trouble. They find themselves facing a criminal charge or investigation.
You got 10 seconds.
Of course, they're going to want someone who's going to represent them, that's going to form some sort of bond with them and get to know them deeper than just hear the charges, you know. Yeah. So that's
sorry I asked you such a front-loaded question and gave you 5 seconds to answer. Mike, what's your phone number? Where can people reach you at?
312-380-6559, Leonard Trial Lawyers.
Anyone that is facing an investigation, or they've been visited by the police, or they've been found liable for a crime, call you, right?
Yep. Always good to talk to you, buddy. Appreciate it.
That's Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney. Mike, one more time the number. Sorry, I gave an extra 10 seconds to you here.
Oh, wow. 312-380-6559, Leonard Trial Lawyers. Thanks, John.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And thanks to Patrick Dolan as well.